To Kate Garuffi, who's coming to you from EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, to provide an introduction. Kate, whenever you're ready, please begin.
Thank you for the introduction, Jean, and welcome everybody to another webinar event under the Design and Construction at Hazardous Waste Sites seminar series. So before I turn it over to our presenters for the day, I just wanted to give everybody on the webinar a little background on the collaboration between EPA and the Society of American Military Engineers, which is the Design and Construction Issues at Hazardous Waste Sites, or DCHWS. Our objectives through this collaboration and the symposiums, webinars, and other training events that I'll discuss in the next slides are to facilitate open and frank information exchange among professionals in both the private and public sectors regarding design and construction issues at hazardous waste sites. It provides a forum for presentations describing current practices and approaches, management techniques, and field experiences in these areas. It also, most importantly, enhances communication network and promotes continued discussion and dialogue around these topics among the professionals in our area. So as I mentioned before, EPA and the Society of American Military Engineers put on a number of events to meet these objectives. The first type of event that we do are symposiums. We have one in the East held in Philadelphia. Unfortunately, in April of 2020, we had to postpone the event, but our next symposium, which will be the 13th delivery, will be actually the last week in March of 2021. You'll be getting more information about that later this calendar year. We have a sister symposium for DCHWS, which is held in the West. It's held in Denver, Colorado. We currently have the fifth delivery scheduled for the last week of October 2020. We are currently planning to do this in person and putting other options in place in case an in-person event cannot happen. So stay tuned for updates on that. In addition to the symposiums, we have a seminar series, which includes webinars like the one you're attending today, and future in-person trainings that we're beginning to plan for in calendar year 2021. One of the things that I wanted to point out, because DCHWS has so many events that we are promoting, we have a new website. A shorthand is dchws.org. Or you can click on the link that I've provided in these slides. When you get to the landing page, you'll have announcements for the East Symposium, the West Symposium, as well as future webinars or in-person training. So it's a really great place to see what's happening with all those events. It'll let you know when we have call for abstracts, registrations open for all of these events. So I encourage you to bookmark that site and visit it frequently. We have some upcoming webinars scheduled for July and August. We're still working to finalize those titles as well as the presenters. Please pay attention to the DCHWS website as well as cluin.org and the TechDirect mailer to get more information on those webinars. I apologize that we can't announce them specifically right now. So before I turn over to our presenters, I'd like to introduce them. Our two presenters are from PS&S. Our first presenter is Mike Newton, who is an LSRP and professional geologist. He's a project manager at PS&S. He has 13 years of experience in the environmental consulting industry, and as I mentioned before, a number of certifications relevant to his project management in the environmental arena. Our second presenter is Jana Seyman. He is the associate principal and environmental engineer at PS&S. He has over 20 years of successful remediation and waterfront construction experience, and he specializes in sediment remediation and shoreline wetland mitigation projects, as well as in-situ containment and treatment of impacted soils and groundwater. So without further ado, I will have Jean pull their slide deck over and turn it over to Mike to get the presentation started. Thank you, everyone.
Wonderful. All right. Thank you very much, Kate and Jean. And thank you to the EPA and SAME for having us. Good afternoon, everybody on the phone. Well, good afternoon to the East Coast, and good morning to the West Coast. I'm Mike Newton. I will be leading off the presentation presenting in tandem with my colleague, Jano Seyman. We'll be sort of trading off the slides back and forth. We both work at PS&S, and we're both based in the state of New Jersey. The presentation we have here for you today focuses on a remediation case study. It's presented here to highlight a variety of design challenges and to provide you all with an overview of how the project team overcame each of those challenges to complete a complex remediation project. Another focus of this presentation is to highlight lessons learned that the project team encountered and navigated throughout the design and construction process. Some of those challenges were technical, regulatory, third-party stakeholder in nature, and so therefore each of those solutions needed to have a unique approach and to take into consideration a myriad of other sort of project obligations and facets. So the project team employed a number of different tactics to overcome those challenges. In general, those include development of a robust remedy alternatives analysis and a conceptual site model that allowed for the various stakeholders and the design team to understand the project dynamics. There was also the performance of a number of pre-design investigations to better inform the design and to provide some comfort to all the different stakeholders and regulators that the design would be protective. And then there were negotiations. When you have so many stakeholders, you need to negotiate the final remedy. In fact, we'll get into it a little bit later, but dispute resolution was even used twice throughout the course of the project to find the right outcome. And lastly, we did end up employing some pretty unique remedial construction techniques and design techniques with sort of cutting-edge remediation technology and materials. So try my hand at moving slides to the next. So I'll start by leading you through some of the site history. Then I will hand it off to Janos, who will then take you through some of the initial remedial actions that were performed at the site. The low-hanging fruit. Then we'll present the challenges to the sort of the last area of sediment remediation that needed to be performed. This is, within the Hudson River, underneath the building, and a conceptual site model was developed as well. We'll talk about that. Then we'll go into the design of the multi-layer sediment capping system that was employed, and Janos will share some of the challenges encountered during the construction as well. And then, at the end, we'll sort of wrap it up by sharing the successes and challenges of that construction and what we ended up having sort of the future site management plan and the long-term integrity monitoring system. So moving forward, we're going to intersperse a few questions throughout the presentation as well. You'll see here we've got the first question is, why were PCBs used at the site? You don't know the answer to that, but hopefully over the next few slides, you'll learn it, and we can confirm at that point that you have. All right, so moving on to the next slide here. Let's see, I lost it. Okay, all right, here we go. PCBs, or polychlorinated biphenyls, are organic chlorine compounds. They're listed with US EPA as a persistent organic pollutant. PCBs were used in the past for a number of different industrial and consumer applications, maybe most notably as insulation fluids in electric transformers, capacitors, and generators, but they were also used in products like fluorescent lamp ballasts, caulk, and carbonless copy paper. PCBs were used at the BICC cable site in the dielectric fluid that was used in the high voltage cables, the large diameter high voltage cables, specifically as a coolant and a heat transmitter. PCBs have been demonstrated to cause a variety of different health effects, Many of you, I'm sure, are very familiar with that. They've known to cause cancer in animals and humans, as well as a number of other serious non-cancer health effects, including effects on the immune system, reproductive, nervous, endocrine, and then a myriad of other adverse health effects. PCBs are regulated by US EPA under TSCA, you know, down to levels as low as 1 mg/kg, depending upon the application. So moving along, so PCBs at the BICC cable site, PCBs were used so for a variety of different purposes historically. BICC, is the British Industrial Cables Corporation. Because of this, because they were used widespread in different processes at the site and in the production of these cables, PCBs were detected in site characterization in a variety of different areas. So you see PCBs along the waterfront in soil and sediment there. You'll see them within and surrounding the research facility building that's on site. At this present time, you see it within historic fill material that was placed to expand the shoreline historically. You will see them at the wire and cable manufacturing facility that's no longer present, in and around floor drains that discharged into the Hudson River, and lastly, you know, along commercial rail sidings as well. Just taking a second to check back in on this question here. It looks like everybody's did a nice job here. PCBs were used for all of the above. Let me see. Okay. So moving on, site operations. They began at this site. This site's been around for a very long time. In 1886 with the manufacture of machinery and tools to harvest sugar. That continued until about 1890, at which time wire and cables began being manufactured at the site. Typically your more typical steel cables, and then you end up in 1915 going to paper insulated, lead jacketed, rubber insulated, and armored submarine cable. So that manufacturing continued until 1996 when operations ceased. However, PCBs were first introduced into the manufacturing operation in roughly the 1960s. These were the cables, the rubber wrapped steel cables with the dielectric fluid in the annular space to provide cooling. And these cables ranged in thickness anywhere from 1/2 inch to 3 inches in diameter. Moving forward, project stakeholders. So as I mentioned in the beginning, a number of different stakeholders were involved throughout the process. And because the site has such a long history and because of its location and the type and levels of contamination, the project had quite a few stakeholders. So we were dealing with NSDEC DER, the Department of Environmental Remediation, NSDEC Fish and Wildlife, US EPA, TSCA, and the Brownfield Cleanup Program, responsible parties and other people with interest were former property owner Phelps Dodge, and the current property owner was a private developer, and then the person responsible for cleaning the site up is the BICC. So let's move forward here. BICC site impact. So as you would expect, this is pretty common at a lot of these remediation sites where you have a variety of different media and a variety of different contaminants. Groundwater was contaminated with volatile organic compounds. Soil had contamination with lead and PCBs. And then we had PCB contaminated sediment as well. I'm getting a little bit of feedback somehow on the other end of the line. Sorry, Gene, but I think at this time I'm going to hand the controls over to Janos. Janos, you out there?
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Catherine and Gene. Welcome, everybody. Happy Wednesday. So on Michael's previous picture, and you can see in this picture, a lot of reinforcing bar, a lot of concrete, and as Michael said, BICC cables. They manufactured cables. So you're going to see that cables have been a challenge from day one at this site. As a debris, as a difficulty in doing various dredging opportunities, as well as some of the upland work. And as you folks know, putting in wells around old discarded cables is not fun. So the first record of decision was issued in 2005 by NYSDEC, and it required the building demolition of the on-site superstructures. The only building that was not demolished is that blue cube, the EPRI building. We'll talk about that a little more later on. Hotspot excavation of PCBs and lead on the upland part of the site. And then the sediment work, the plan was for excavation of 2 feet to 4 feet to 6 feet, depending on where you were along the waterfront, to remove the impacted sediment. And then the engineering controls were waterfront stabilization measures. So either steel sheet pile or composite vinyl fiberglass sheet piles. And then a revetment stone shoreline for the majority of the southern section of the site. And then the bulk of the upland area was a pavement cover system and a very limited soil cover system along the railroad track. And then as you learn later on, you'll see we prepared a ROD amendment in July 2014 that bifurcated the site and created Operable Unit 1, which is the entire upland area, and then Operable Unit 2 is just the sediment below that blue cube, the EPRI building. Okay, next slide. This was the challenging area. This is the OU2 area, the sediment beneath the EPRI building or the Blue Cube. I'll give you a quick history of the Blue Cube. It was built in 1966 in the east-west direction, which is left to right on the page. That's 170 feet. In the north-south direction, up and down the page, it's 250 feet. The clear open span in that building is 110 feet. This building was built for EPRI to do research on these armored cables. And what they would do, there was a large gantry crane inside the building, and it's all black inside, and there was laboratories, glass, photo booths, things like that, where they would string the cables up, induce a current through them, and see how the cables reacted. Were they good, or were there defects in the cable? So this was a research and testing building. Once they stopped operations in 1966, the building was actually converted to the Hudson River stage, which was used to film multiple movies like The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, Zoolander, Girl on a Train, multiple episodes of TV shows for Netflix as well as HBO. So it had a very rich history. When the private developer bought the property, he was more interested in the amazing view corridor. If you're out on this building, on this waterfront, you could see up the Hudson River Valley. You'll see the new Mario Cuomo Bridge. A great northern view corridor of the Palisades as well as the western Palisades and the New Jersey shoreline. And then looking south, you see the George Washington Bridge, you see Manhattan, and that wonderful skyline. So it really is a a great view shed, and the developer wanted to preserve this building. So, as I said before, we broke out the dredge areas into dredge certification units, and they were concentrated around the site, the northern area, which was upstream of the main part of the site, which was 17 acres upland and about 6 acres of open water. So, actually, Gene, can you give me the green arrow, please? Thanks, Gene. So this is north. This shows you the old railroad line. This was the initial Hudson River shoreline. It was a stable surface, so that's where Conrail, that's where MTA built their passenger and commercial rail lines. That's still an active rail line. So that was the old shoreline, and then you could see with time, and from the 1800s to the 1960s, they built out this property. So you could see, obviously, a lot of historic fill, which presents its own challenges, and then the site operations. So this area was a 2-foot dredge. This area was a 2-foot dredge. This area used to be below a building. Once they demolished the building, they provided access to this open water area and the sediment. That was a 2-foot dredge of PCB and lead impacted soils. And then as we go further south, you had 2 to 4 foot dredging of PCB and lead impacted soils. And this outline here is the bulk of our presentation today, the EPRI building. Again, it's 250, 250 feet in the northwest direction, 170 feet in the east-west direction. Okay. This two pictures present the conditions before we started the dredging underneath the building and then the eventual capping efforts. The building was supported on H-piles, 4 H-piles per cluster. This column bent was the A-line. This is the furthest to the east. And then you went from A to G going out into the Hudson River. And then there were also batten piles on the B bent, the B column line, okay? The spacing, the clear spacing between the pile caps is about 18 feet. The center-to-center spacing on the pile caps was 22 feet. So not a lot of room to maneuver equipment. These pictures were taken at low tide, which gives you about 8 feet of clearance with no waves. At high tide, you only had about 3.5 feet of clearance. So we definitely had to work the tidal cycle, and we'll talk about that a little later on, but those were the constraints vertically underneath that building. Okay? As Michael mentioned before, we're on the Hudson River in Yonkers, right north of Manhattan, so there's a lot of commercial traffic, a lot of big marine vessels carrying goods up and down the river, so boat wakes were a concern on 3 to 4 feet, and we're going to talk about that later on, but just envision that as we're going through this presentation. So the OU2 footprint was 16,000 square feet of PCB impacted sediment. So Gene, I lost the green pointer. Oh, there it is. Sorry. Right here was approximately the location of the floor drain outfall from the previous operations from the old buildings. That outfall drained about here, and you could see that there was a nice plume of PCB-impacted sediment. This was required to be a 6-foot deep dredge, 2-foot, and then there was a 4-foot dredge, and then the perimeter 2-foot dredge, okay? The total cubic yardage of impacted sediment was estimated based on endpoint sampling, you know, proposed endpoint sampling, at 4,500 cubic yards. Okay, and as we further go along, the dredge impact area was 16,000, but for factors of safety, we added at least 5 foot on each side, and that gave us the 24,000 square foot dredge footprint. So, from day one, once I first rolled out to the site with the client, we saw the vertical constraints, the horizontal constraints. The upland work was pretty straightforward to do the upland offsite disposal. We relied on Conrail. We relied on that rail siding to remove that material. So that was pretty straightforward. And as Mike alluded to before, we saved the best for the last. The dredging below the EPRI building. So, as I said before, it's about 4,500 cubic yards, average 4 to 6 foot impacted soil excavation depths or dredge depths. So, to tackle this, we met with a couple contractors and we actually built a true to scale wood model in the PS&S workshop to visualize the building, to visualize the constraints. You can't see it in this picture, but we actually have string lines showing the low water as well as the high water lines. And then this allowed us to really evaluate the dredging options, the 6 dredging options that were employed, and then the sediment capping operations, which we'll discuss further on. Michael will talk about a little more, but an important factor with this building, it was a two-way slab, so there was reinforcing bars in the east-west direction as well as the north-south direction. Because of the age of the building, the type of foundations, we could not open up large windows like I have shown here. You could not open large windows through that reinforcing steel. We were only able to successfully demolish and then reinforce 8-foot by 8-foot windows in between each of the column vents. And you'll see photos later on, but that allowed us access for dredging and then sediment capping efforts. Okay? So those are the access constraints. We're going to talk about the wave energies and the current velocity as we discuss the sediment cap design effort, and then the risk-based science. That was something we worked with the EPA when we prepared the task required submissions and the risk-based approval approach. So the next question is, how extensive are your alternatives analyses? Give everybody a couple minutes. Okay. Michael, is it okay? I'll hand it back to you to start going through some of the sediment remediation alternatives analyses we did for first the dredging effort and then the sediment capping effort, please.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I'll circle back for getting the answers to these questions. All right. I hope everyone can hear me still. Sediment remediation alternatives analysis. We looked at four different sediment alternatives analyses, 6 different attempts. So as Janos described earlier, we had a pretty large area and a lot of volume of sediment that needed to be remediated. So we sought to remove that material, a total of about 4,500 cubic yards. The EPRI building, you know, we may not have said it, it's the Electronic Power Research Institute building. Janos may have They're so dead. The building, it extends out into the water, 150 feet, and then it's 250 feet across. So the contaminated sediment thickness ranged anywhere between 2 and 6 feet. So we attempted various dredging techniques, which I'm about to get into. Some of them involved diver-assisted, robotic, etc. There were 6 separate attempts. Each of them was unsuccessful in achieving the remedial objectives. We established the dredge abort criteria in agreement with NSDAC and EPA for that 6th dredging attempt, and I'll talk about that as well. And then lastly, we ended up reaching a technical and practicability point and prepared a technical justification report to document the unsuccessful dredge attempts and the need for a different remedy. So moving forward, want to talk first here about the dredge excavation from the floor of the building. So the attempt number one, using a machine with a telescoping and rotating arm excavator to get at the sediment. We performed select demolition of the slab, but we were constrained by access and geometry, and as Janos alluded to, we were unable to cut open large holes in the floor, and because that limited access was there, we couldn't reach the areas that we needed to. Next, we looked at attempt number two using a mini excavator rather than this the rotating and telescoping arm. That too was unsuccessful for the same reasons, unable to reach the areas that we needed to through the limited access hole in the floor. So attempt number three, we looked at a variety of different hydraulic dredging techniques and attempted them. These included a vacuum dredge, an auger dredge, which is kind of like taking a snowblower under the building and funneling that sediment out through, channeling it out and then sending it out through hoses and tubing to a sediment containment area. That was unsuccessful as well. And a pit hog dredge using a suction head affixed to an excavator arm inside the building. None of those were successful. The biggest problem that we had was there's too much debris. So this isn't your typical loose, unconsolidated bed of sediment. There was a number of different debris components, old steel cables, large coarse gravels from the fill material, you name it. So we were constrained there. So circling back to the alternatives analysis, it looks like everybody has different levels of extensiveness on the alternatives evaluation. That makes sense. You want to suit your alternatives analysis to the job at hand. So in this case, we had some great complexity. We had to evaluate as many alternatives as possible. Sometimes when you know what the right option is, you don't really need to evaluate too many other things. So all right, let me move on here. We also did diver-assisted dredging. We looked at hybrid dredging techniques. And then lastly, we looked at a robotic dredge, and that was the last thing we tried here. So let me go straight to that. So this was the 6th attempt, the robotic dredge. NSDEC approved an abort criteria of 100 cubic yards per day over a 24-hour period. Work in 24-hour, 7-day-a-week shifts. So we spent 22 days on the water, and we had 18 days of production. That 18 days of production only yielded 57 cubic yards of dredge excavation, dredge sediment removal. So only, you know, two 20 by 20 cells. That's not enough. That poor production equals out to be only about 3 cubic yards per day. And given that we needed to remove 4,500 cubic yards, that adds out to about a 1,500 day project, which is infeasible. So want to take a look. Here's some pictures. I'm going to use the screen pointer here. See this picture here. You could see some of the sediment got suspended when the robot began working and settled back down on top of the robot, making it impossible to move the robot. It had to be retrieved. So that was a challenge, and that happens because of a lot of the debris and stirring up the sediment. The robot itself, it does create a little bit of a disturbance moving around down there, especially when it's going over cables and wood piles and everything. So that was a challenge. Another challenge you could see here in this picture, you see some coarse gravel getting stuck in the gears. So that's, you know, here in the track gears. The coarse gravel gets stuck in the track gears. A small thing like that shuts the machine down and makes it challenging to even retrieve. So there was a lot of fear and of the risk of losing the machine. That's quite an expense, as you can imagine. So let's see. Is that everything I wanted to talk about? Okay, so I think at this time we're able to open up and take some questions about the content here, and Janos and I can both answer the questions if anybody has them. Gene, do you want them to enter those questions in on the Q&A, in the Q&A box?
Yep, that's exactly right. So that Q&A window has been open. You can continue to submit your comments and questions there. We do have some that are already in the queue, and this first one is asking, did you run into any problems with dredge residuals having attempted several different techniques or different pieces of equipment?
Janos, you up for taking that one?
And so, Janos, if you need some help here, oh, there you are, Janos. Go ahead and answer if you like. So, Janos, you might still be on mute on your phone. You might need to hit the mute button right there on your phone line.
Is that better?
That's better. We have you now. Thank you.
That's a great question. Dredge residual management, so for the first five attempts underneath the building, as well as the open water attempts, we built a small impoundment on the property, about 200 feet by 200 feet, just concrete bin blocks, geomembrane, geotubes, and we were able to successfully dewater the sediment, and then we loaded it out by trucks. Since it was TSCA-level PCB-impacted sediment, it went out west for proper transportation and disposal. For the final dredge attempt number six, we were prepping for over 100 cubic yards a day of actual sediment, but that was more of about 100 gallons per minute of hydraulic vacuum dredging. So we, before we mobilized the scan crawler, the contractor spent over a month preparing a 3-acre dredge management area with the geomembrane liner, geotubes, bypass pumps, as well as the main pumps to manage this robotic dredge material. Unfortunately, and as Michael said, in 22 days we dredged 57 yards, so that 3-acre dredge management area was wholly and mostly unused. As part of that, as you folks would think, we did have a wastewater treatment plant on site, so we collected the decant water. We did obtain the required speedies permit, We treated the water, and then we discharged it back to the Hudson River downstream of our project area. Hopefully that answered your question.
Thank you so much. So again, I'm not sure if this is a Janos or a Mike question, but can you talk about methods you may have used to monitor or minimize turbidity?
I'll take that, Michael, if that's okay with you. So with the turbidity, we were required to have the type 3 turbidity curtain around the entire perimeter of the project. When we were doing the sediment dredging, both the open water as well as underneath the EFRI building. And we did up gradient and down gradient turbidity monitoring, and we did not have an exceedance, so above the background condition. This part of the Hudson River is pretty silty, and it's brackish water, so turbidity was never a concern for us. And we controlled the operations, we controlled the equipment, good contractor best management practices. And we had that turbidity curtain as a stopgap measure outboard of our dredge footprint.
All right, excellent. I think we'll go ahead and resume with the presentation. We've got about an hour and 15 minutes or so left with our time today. So feel free to carry on with the presentation. I do see some of those additional questions that are in the queue, so if you were just starting to type them in, please know your questions aren't lost. We will stop again for a Q&A break shortly. So thank you, and I'll turn it back to our presenters.
Thanks, Jean. So we're at the stage, we tried the 6 dredge attempts. We did have a remedial action work plan approval that presented a sediment cap. However, it was a good time to pause. So a technical justification report was prepared and submitted to NYSDEC as well as to the EPA documenting the 6 unsuccessful dredge attempts because of safety, security, and debris concerns, like Michael summarized. So that technical justification report was accepted by NYSDEC as well as the EPA, and that set the path forward for the sediment cap design for the TSCA level impacted sediment underneath the EPRI building. Okay, so the main goals for the sediment cap, and again, it was about 24,500 square feet, was active treatment and containment right at the bottom of this river. And then you had to do scour protection to protect that active treatment and containment layer. And then on top of that, on the eastern side, and I'm going to take the pointer, this eastern shoreline, here we only had about 5 feet of water above the active treatment and containment layer, so we had to protect that with more armor protection. As you went out into the river, the western shore of the building, you had 30 feet of water at low tide. So there was a gradual grade from east to west out into the river. And then the armor protection, and we'll talk about that more as part of the HECRAS wave managing current velocity study. The armor protection was protecting the perimeter of the sediment cap from scour, from sediment loss, as well as the eastern side from the wave energies that could impact the top of that cap. At this stage, we also looked at in situ stabilization of the impacted sediment coming in and mixing in reagents to solidify the mass and stabilize it. But because of that heavy debris, the success rate was a concern, as well as contractors did not feel like they could access the entire footprint safely and effectively. So ISS of the impacted sediment was identified as a non-starter. Okay, so the next thing, the big thing was a wave energy and current velocity study. That was required. So if we could ask the audience real quick, Gene, what was the controlling factor, please?
And I'll just remind for the audience, for those of you who might be on a mobile device, if you can't see those questions on the screen, remember you can always type in your response using the Q&A window because the question is posed on the slide. So we encourage you to use the interactive polls, but you can certainly type your answer into the Q&A.
So I'm seeing the responses then, yes, the majority is correct. Wave energy was the controlling factor. Thank you. This is a picture, and I'll talk about it later on. This is after we built the sediment cap, but there was a nor'easter that came through the Hudson River Valley, and that's a large runaway construction barge that was floating in the Hudson River. Those are 4 to 5 foot waves with white caps, so wave energy hitting that eastern edge of the sediment cap was of concern, and the potential undermining of that sediment cap and the exposure of that impacted sediment. So what did we do? We obtained a whole bunch of data, storm data, modeled that for 25-year, 75-year, 100-year storm events, as well as the historical hurricanes that hit this area. I'll pause here for a minute. This is a view looking north. This is the former Tappan Zee Bridge. The Mario Cuomo Bridge is right in this area. This is the New Jersey Palisades. This is the blue cube, and this was the BICC site. This is the EPRI building. So in Superstorm Sandy, the average water elevation is about 3.5 feet. Superstorm Sandy came up to 10.5 feet. So the EPRI building floor slab is elevation seven. There's 3.5 feet of water that came through this site area during the Superstorm Sandy storm surge. So that was one of our design factors, is to be the sediment cap needed to survive that type of storm event. Okay? The big concern is after 6 unsuccessful dredging attempts, we had to come up with a design that can be built. So we worked with several contractors and several qualified marine contractors to do a deep dive, a very robust constructability review. That wooden model I showed you before, we carried it around throughout the tri-state area, meeting with the regulators as well as contractors to come up with a plan, to come up with a design that was buildable. So the HECRAS model identified that, yes, we needed the design for current velocity, and that was the scarab protection layer, and we selected Tenkanti geotubes that were cut to fit in between each of the column bays, and then we filled them once they were on the floor of the Hudson River, and I'll show you some pictures of that later on, and then the wave energy, and there's two zones. Zone one is that eastern edge where we only had about 5 feet of water, and we had a design to address that 5-foot wave height. And then zone two is where we had the deeper water areas. Okay. Question, what is the average Hudson River velocity in the site area? Very good. Everybody knows this Hudson River region, 6 feet per second. So that's pretty quick. And it definitely presented challenges for mobilizing equipment, materials, as well as the labor force underneath that building to build the cap. And we're going to talk about things we did to effectively build the cap. So this picture is the eastern edge of the cap. There actually was a fiberglass composite containment bulkhead that was installed to protect the impacted sediment inboard of the EPRI building. They dredged the top 2 feet, but the sediment at depth was protected by this containment bulkhead. So these are the timber supports for the whaler system as well as for the composite fiberglass bulkhead. This is the EPRI underbuilding area. So we looked at stone riprap, and that was eventually what was installed. And then for the armor protection, we looked also at the Kontech Ajex concrete armor units. We've used them on several bridge abutment jobs in the past, and these interlocking concrete units, to achieve the D50 of 48 inches, we could use big stone, or we could use only 24 inches of the concrete armor units. So like I said before, this is just a NOAA tie chart. The armor protection layer, the design requirement was a D50 of 24 to 30 inches was the HECRAS model result. However, the DEC and the EPA required a minimum of 1.5 factor safety. So we designed and we constructed a D50 of 48 inches for our armor protection in zone one. In zone two, we required only a D50 of 12, but we installed a D50 of 24 inches. So actually a 2 factor safety. Okay. The shallow zone before, like I said, it was a D50 of 48 inches. This picture on the right, on the left, is a little blurry, but this is the shoreline steel bulkhead that protected the on-site area. This is looking south at the EPRI building, at the Blue Cube. This is a January 2017 nor'easter. You can see the backwater effect. There's only about a foot of water between the bulkhead, which is at 11, and, excuse me, which is at 8, and the water is about 7, 7.5 right now. So you could see the backwater, the tidal surge here. So to achieve that D50 of 48 inch, we looked at class 5 riprap or the 24 inch long Kontech Ajex. Okay. Michael, do you want to take over or you want me to?
Sure. Yeah. I'm happy to jump in. I'll take the next set of slides here. So as Janos did a nice job preparing everyone. The selected remedy here is the multi-layer sediment capping system. We settled upon that because there was not a method of sediment removal, i.e. dredging, that would be feasible for use beneath the building. The sediment needed to be placed under an engineering control. So the regulatory agency wasn't thrilled about that at first. In fact, they were pretty adamant that sediment removal needed to occur, given how sensitive the Hudson River is. So, however, in this case, it just was not feasible. So we pursued the path of approval for the cap, and we were able to receive a revised record of decision from NSDEC. Now, the cap, as Yano said, it needed to be protective enough to withstand the flow conditions of the Hudson River and robust enough to prevent any exposure in the future from migration of the underlying sediments back into the river. NSDEC provided this record of decision for implementation of the SCS remedy to the design team, and we proceeded with the design. Just to sort of step back, it helps to get record of decision documentation. it helps the design team, the responsible party, the contractors doing the construction, to be able to see what specifically the requirements are and have them in writing. That helps the project continue to move forward. As Janos mentioned, one of the issues was this factor of safety, which, you know, we ended up producing a redundant design that was in excess of the calculated size of the armor protection. And we ended up going back and forth and finally settling on this 1.5, 50% increase, you know, factor of safety. So the design requirements also, we had to use some risk-based science, especially to seek the EPA approval through TSCA. We also had to design this in the event of a severe storm, which we all know, you know, Hurricane Sandy is the most recent example, occur in this area. Let me move along. So here's sort of a summary of the multi-layer cap. We had a cushioned sand layer directly on top of the sediment. This is, we needed to protect the active treatment layer from the debris and the cables, et cetera, that were mixed in with the sediment and at the surface there beneath the building. Then, as I said, we had this active treatment layer. We used, I'll get into that in a second, actually. So active treatment layer, above that was a ballast protection layer to keep the overlying armor from damaging in the future that treatment containment layer. Then we had the armor, and then finally there's a habitat mitigation layer. So moving forward, the active treatment layer, this was a Setco organoclay reactive core mat. We used that throughout the treatment area. 0.8 pounds per square feet of organoclay in between two geotextiles. Then there's also the organoclay activated carbon reactive core mat, which is the what we used as sort of the funnel and gate. So that's where water can pass up and through the area and be treated as it migrates. Geotextile provides that separation between the layers. It also prevents intermixing, and it also adds some tensile strength. The continuous and overlapping active treatment was successfully used. It has been successfully used, so we have a good history of successful use of this installation of bridges and piers. We also had a really good recent job completed in 2012 in Utica. Very similar setting, very similar scenario, PCB impacted sediment in the harbor. And organoclay reactive core mat was used successfully there. So we had those things in the tool belt. Regulatory decisions. So there was obviously in a project like this a lot of back and forth with regulators, with the regulatory agencies that were involved. Some of the key aspects of that were the project remedial action plan provided to NSDAC. That was the first document. We did a number of the dredges under that plan. The record of decision for OU2, which is the sediment underneath the EPRI building. The NSDAC remedial action work plan that was issued and prepared by the design team, which summarized the details of the cap. There was the EPA risk-based plan, risk-based approval 761.61C. That had to go in and get approved as well. Then we also had other agency approvals like a water quality certificate, the Army Corps of Engineers permitting. We also had NOAA habitat mitigation requirements as well as fish window requirements In this case, we submitted a fish window waiver request and got that approved to continue performing the installation during the fish window as that was necessary to get the installation done properly and effectively. Gonna move on here. So the multi-layer so we're gonna talk a little bit about dispute resolution here. Originally, we entered into the first dispute resolution to speed up the timeline of the brownfield cleanup program's review and approval of the remedial action work plan. It's typically a 45-day review process. That time frame began lagging, and dispute resolution was needed to push it across the finish line. You don't like to have to do that, but in that case, it really helped move the project forward, so it was useful. The second dispute resolution was a 2015 dispute related to the habitat mitigation. The project team received additional habitat mitigation requirements once the construction was already underway. And at that time, it wasn't feasible really to install any additional habitat mitigations. So the project team initiated dispute resolution again to find the right solution, and it was again helpful in settling on the use of an off-site mitigation banking system to meet the habitat mitigation requirements for the project. So moving on here, this is a picture of a portion of the design here, the perimeter design. You can see the Ajax there in the design. What we did too, this is another important design consideration, is we did a dual design at first for the constructability review using stone riprap as well as the Ajax blocks. And we got that, both of those designs approved by the agency so that we could let the contractors select the means and methods to construct in the most efficient way possible. You know, again, getting this thing implemented was critical, very important. We couldn't really have sort of a failed installation, so we had to make sure we had the right and constructible method. So you can see the different areas. Zone one is the wave affected area by the shoreline under the building. Zone two, wave unaffected, kind of perpetually underwater, basically. A little bit less armor, but still the same. And then you also have the taper off by the edge of the remediation area. Along here. So here's just another view of the sediment capping system with the armor. You can see the reactive core mat in there. There's the in the blue, the 10-kate material at the base, and then you've got your ballast, and then your armor layer. So yeah, just another design there. So here's another question. I'll pose this question and then talk about the contingency plans that the project team used. So how important to you is your contingency plan on your project? And by contingency plan, I mean a variety of different contingencies that you may encounter during construction. Contingency plans are what your plan is for an abnormal condition, such as severe weather, hazardous waste being encountered where it wasn't expected, etc. We all are used to having an emergency response plan in our health and safety plans. That's required by OSHA. Contingency plans for other contingencies are equally, maybe even more so, important in cases like this, projects like this. So, hurricane contingency plan. So as we talked about before, Superstorm Sandy came through here We had Irene as well. We also had Hurricane Doria. Okay, so sorry, I guess I lost the Q&A part, but I assume everybody felt like the contingency plan was pretty important, right? Oh, there it is. I got it back. Thanks, Dean. So very. Okay, great. And that's the way that we feel too. These contingency plans were important. So severe weather was obviously a concern. The next concern was ice flows in the Hudson River. You could see here one ice flow situation. I forget which year this was, but you could see the damage here. I'll point it out to these piers. The wooden piers are damaged. So, and it actually rendered this walkway unusable, and it needed to be repaired during the course of the project. So ice flows was another reason to have a contingency plan. Other construction and safety concerns, these weren't just the project team and the responsible party being concerned here. NISDAC and EPA also had safety concerns. So we needed to factor all of that in, incorporate them into our health and safety planning, as well as the contractor's health and safety planning. All right. SCS construction. So as I mentioned, the agencies had a number of concerns. Because of the multiple failed dredge attempts, they were concerned, can this be constructed? Can it be done safely as well? And the other concern is, how will you demonstrate that the remedy is effective, not only in the long term, but once you complete, how do you demonstrate that everything is where it needs to be? So we engage contractors throughout the design process, and then obviously in the bid phase, to provide their best means and methods to do the job effectively. We couldn't have done it without that, and I can't stress it enough that it's very important throughout the design process to get the input of the people that are going to be doing the construction. We designers would be naive to think that we can do it without contractor expertise. And then also conversations with experienced marine contractors as well, so divers, et cetera. How feasible is it to install these various components of the sediment capping system? Okay, so here is another image of the design. You can see this red area. I'll use my pointer. So this red area, this is the wave affected area along the shoreline under the building. This is the area that needed additional stabilization and additional armor to protect. These boxes here, these red and gray boxes, these are the bin boxes with mafia blocks. They acted as a barrier for wave action along the shore as an additional layer of protection. You can see here, this is a bridge onto the project site. This was constructed for access during construction. And you also see these monitoring points for monitoring the bathymetry during and post-construction. Let's move on here. All right, so here's sort of a better view of these H-piles supporting the building and the mafia block bin boxes that were used to protect the shoreline from the wave action. So just going to keep going here for the sake of time. All right, so here's another good view of the design here. We've got a cross section. You can see the building piers up here. You can see here the taper. So over here, let's see, we've got the shoreline. You've got your additional bin boxes to protect from wave action. A thicker armor layer here right up along the shore. your active treatment zone all the way throughout, and then just these differing layers of thickness of armor protection for the cap on top. And then it's really important here that this cap is keyed in to the sediment at the extent of the remedial area. And obviously that's important for the long-term stability of this cap. One more here. All right, so here's a good view of how we installed the cap to surround the H piles. And we use sandbags. Use sandbags filled with organoclay, lapped up onto the mat and against the piles to keep continuous protection. Then we used PVC filled with sand to weight down and act as ballast. And then we had again sandbags on top of sandbags, basically. So I think this is a good time to turn it over to a few more questions and then hand off to Janos.
Okay. We do have a number of questions that have come in on the queue, so I'll take a few now. I do just want to do a quick time check. We've got about 45 minutes left in the session today. So let's just pause and take one or two questions now. Somebody wanted to know why or how did you seal that cap around all of the pilings? And so, Janos, if that's a question that you can help with, I'm going to unmute you in the system here. So if you have your mute button turned on, Janos, if you want to unmute and help again, the question was, how did you seal the cap around the pilings?
Gene, can you hear me?
I can.
So that's a great question, and I'm going to answer that as we go through the next slide deck sections with some representative photographs. But you'll see it was basically hand cutting and placing it with the divers in the north-south, east-west direction, and then we used the organoclay bulk sandbags to infill the actual webbing of the H piles. So we'll talk about that more as we go through some of the photographs of the actual construction.
Okay. And I have a two-part question for this next one. How much volume did the cap add to the existing sediment bed? Or what was the change in elevation of the surface sediment? That's the first question.
So that's a great question. And long story short, and I apologize, we didn't talk about it earlier on. The EPRI building is sitting on H piles that go to bedrock, which is about 80 feet below where the current Hudson River bottom is. So there's about 70 to 80 feet of soft, compressible sediment. So we did extensive geotechnical studies both to make sure that when we place the cap's not going to slide away and cause, you know, localized failure. And then we did model total settlement. Primary consolidation settlement was on the order of 2 to 2.5 feet. And then creep on the order of inches, long-term secondary creep. So during the construction, during the 3-month-long construction, we saw that primary settlement of 2 feet. So the cap itself, the SECO reactive core mat, the cushion layer, the geotubes, and then the main area, not the wave-affected area, the zone 2 main area, was about 2.5 feet. So we put that 2.5 feet down, it settled, and we pretty much matched within 6 inches the existing Hudson River bathymetry. And that was required by both DEC remediation as well as the Fish and Wildlife folks, that we restored back to the original Hudson River bathymetry. We were allowed to be higher in that zone 1, that wave-affected area. We got a variance from DEC remediation as well as Fish and Wildlife, because we had to protect that edge of the cap right along the shoreline adjacent to that containment bulkhead. So there we were allowed to be higher. The restored bathymetry at the end of the day was about 2 feet higher than the pre-existing bathymetry.
Okay, and I think you actually just naturally answered their second part, was how exactly did permitting work with respect to changing that holding capacity of the river in that area?
Yes, and it's hard to tell, but if you recall that one slide of the entire river, this river is about 5,800 feet wide at this part of Yonkers, so there's a lot of holding capacity, and our small 10,000 square feet did not affect that. We did have to model it and prove to NYSDEC that with the HECRES modeling that this tidally influenced river, that additional foot and a half, 2 feet of sediment, of sediment cap in zone one will not affect the flow of the Hudson River. And we demonstrated that, and we got the necessary variances and approvals.
Okay. Well, I think just in the interest of time, why don't we move on with the presentation? We will stop again for Q&A, but I'll turn it back to our presenters.
Thank you, Jean. So we talked about the settlement. We needed to design and build a flexible section. Also, the big concern is we needed to protect the work as the sediment cap was being built or deployed across the Hudson River bottom. So we came up with the selected contractor 6 deployment units. And from a quality control, quality assurance point of view, each deployment unit had its own certification, its own sheet for each column bent, where we approved the engineer as well as the contractor's engineer. We reviewed the bathymetric measurements. We reviewed the volume of material, the square footage, confirmed it with design drawings, and then we both signed off on it. So the 6 deployment units. The first was the cushion sand layer, and that was required to bridge all the debris that was left over, the cables that cut off H piles, timber piles, that stone that Michael showed you pictures of, all that material. We pumped cushion sand down to create a nice level platform. Then we placed deployment unit number 2 was the first layer of reactive core mat. That was in the east-west direction. Deployment unit number 3 was the second layer of reactive core mat in the north-south direction, yes. And then the deployment unit number 3 also addressed the organoclay and the smaller RCM panels in and around the HPAL clusters. The 4th deployment unit was the geotube installations that were installed north-south in between the column bents and then tied in the east-west direction. Then the 5th was the armor stone and concrete block installations. And we really were creative, and you'll see how we being the contractor, designed and constructed specialty equipment to deploy that stone as well as the concrete blocks. And then the final deployment unit, and we'll talk a lot more later on, is the load cells for the redundant sediment cap monitoring system. So as we discussed before, there are a lot of vertical clearance constraints, our timing restrictions. We had the fish window. We mobilized to the site in August, and I'll talk about it a little more later on, but we had 3 months of required site preparation work, and then it was a 3-month construction window. The fish window was in effect from February to May, but we did get that variance, as Michael said before. We had to work the tidal cycle. as you may recall, during high tide, there's only about 3.5 feet of vertical clearance between the water and the bottom of the equity building floor slab. So we had to work the tidal cycle. Major storm events. Thankfully, we only had two major storm events during the August through February timeframe. One was a hurricane that brought a tidal surge up the river of about 2 feet, and then we had one nor'easter in January that also brought about a 2-foot tidal surge up. But we were able to secure the equipment, protect the cap, and keep working. And then winter weather, we were building it with ice, with winter weather conditions. Thankfully, it was a warm winter, that winter of 2015-2016, where we only had 2 days with below freezing temperatures where we had ice buildup concerns. And thankfully, those days were when we were placing the stone riprap, so we didn't need divers and engineers walking along the flexi floats. Like I said before, we had a robust QA/QC program with the deployment unit completion reports. And this was a very diver-intensive work, and we'll show some pictures of that. And then we had specialty tools built specifically for this project, a rock delivery barge. So site preparation, we needed 3 months of that. If you recall, Michael showed the picture of the damaged perimeter walkway from the ice flows. Before we built the sediment cap, we actually had to demolish that concrete walkway and that timber framing. So this picture shows that. Also, if you remember Michael's contingency plan slide, that showed one of the H piles underneath the building. And unfortunately, the cathodic protection we found out when we were doing our pre-assessment dive inspections was not really working, and we had severe section loss on several of the perimeter piles. So before we could put divers and work crews underneath the building, a robust program was performed to reinforce the perimeter of the building, the H piles. Steel plates were installed both on the web and flanges and through bolted through to reinforce that. And then it was several months of mobilizing the necessary construction equipment and materials, and then preparing the reactive core mat and Tenkanki geotubes on site. As you folks know, the Tenkanti comes in, you know, the 20-foot rolls, so we had a nice system inside the building. Thankfully, it was that wide open space, so we rolled it out. We cut it into the required sheets to fit in between the pile bends. So that's the right picture. The left picture is the windows that we installed through the EPRI building floor. We were allowed to go up to 8 feet by 8 feet, and these windows allowed access through that through the two-way slab for equipment as well as material deliveries. So these pictures, the picture on the right is us working on the north side of the building. We have flexi floats as well as push boats that came in with the reactive core mat, then the divers suited up and deployed that on the bottom. You see a whole bunch of yellow rope. Those yellow ropes also had blue or white or red flag, and depending where we are. And we used that as our quality control, quality assurance measures, where we were talking with the diver and the tender as well as the dive master. Okay, each Colin Bent had a color, so he rolled it out. The first 20 feet was a blue ribbon, so he matches the blue ribbon to Colin Bent B. And then the red ribbon matched Colin Bent C, so we knew that we were rolling out to the right geometry and we were providing the necessary coverage. The right picture is us floating in the geotube. The white lines are tags that we use to tie up along the H piles before we infilled the geotube with the sand. This is a picture. Again, this is your 8-foot by 8-foot windows where we used to access. You have your floating, your flexi floats, your wooden platforms that we were working from. You could see the yellow cord with the ribbon showing our different areas. And what we're doing here is we're floating in a geotube. This is zone one, the wave affected zone. And we're preparing to infill it through this flap here. Okay? The next picture, the right picture, like I said before, the contractor actually designed and manufactured for this project these rock delivery barges. So basically what they did is they took a CAT excavator track with a hydraulic power unit and HPU and put two large floating ballasts around it. And then we created a hopper. We infilled it with the stone. And then they drove it, they pushed it underneath the EPRI building to a specific area. Then they activated the walking floor and discharged the stone to a specific area of the site. So you can see the right photograph shows the hopper barge actually working, the stone delivery barge, which we named the Kraken. It delivered the stone to the specific areas of the sediment cap. As the stone was being placed, we were also taking active measurements with a steel pole as well as tapes to confirm that we had the required thickness of the D50 stone. The right picture, this is zone one. Excuse me, the left picture, this is zone one. That's the shoreline here, column A, column line B, and we had the 8x8 windows, and we were using a small payloader to deliver the stone, and then we used an excavator to push the stone in between these areas to create the 4-foot-thick stone riprap. And this is just the summary table. We had each column bent. And then we approved the different various layers, both the engineer from the contractor and then the PS&S engineer approving each and every column bent and the different deployment units. Safety was a concern throughout this project. It was a concern. Can we build it? Can we build it safely? So between the marine contractor and the engineer, we had a third-party safety consultant review our health and safety plans, review our JHAs. And then we had periodic regulator inspections by the EPA and NYSDEC. We also had a third-party engineer there on behalf of the private developer who was going to reuse the site. So with all those people working over those 6 months, we had over 15,000 man hours worked. We worked safely with zero first aids and zero OSHA recordables. It's just a very proud statistics of this project. It was a great team effort, a lot of open communication and just stressing the importance of safety. Every day we had daily safety briefings. We talked about the weather. We talked about the work operations in a specific deployment unit, a specific column bent. We also had a river watcher that was specifically assigned to watch the river and radio to the dive master as well as to the tender if there was a large commercial vehicle, a large commercial vessel coming up or down the river. And when that wake was coming along, river watcher notified the dive master and the tender, and we notified the divers to keep them safe. So it was a very proud accomplishment. Again, zero first aids and zero OSHA recordables with over 15,000 man hours working underneath that building. So now's the time to pause for some construction questions, please.
We had a question that came in asking, do you believe capping would have been possible if you had a condition of no airspace under that building?
I feel that the question is no, because we knew that there was going to be some settlement, and it was a real challenge to work with the regulators to convince them to approve the variance to allow that allowable net fill. Because of the 6 failed dredge attempts, we couldn't create airspace by dredging. We had to rely on that primary consolidation and the downward movement of the sediment cap, and that's why we designed and then installed those multiple deployment units to allow for flexibility. You have a consistent reactive core mat that is separate from the geotubes, which protected the reactive core mat from the scour velocities. And then we placed on top of that the stone riprap and the concrete bin block. So they were separate units, but they were all placed to build one's complete sediment cap. So there was flexibility built into the design to allow for that differential settlement. And we're going to talk about that a little later on how we're monitoring the long-term integrity of this cap.
Okay, we'll take one more question and then we'll move on. What PCB breakthrough time was the cap designed to achieve?
Good question. The PCB break time, the reactive core mat is 50 years. So we designed it for twice that because we put 2 layers of reactive core mat in. So this cap is designed for at least 50 years with the factor safety with the double layer of reactive core mat.
All right, thank you. I think we'll just go ahead and move on in the interest of time. Remember, we've got about 25 minutes or so left for presentation content, and then we will pause again for Q&A. So I'll turn it back to our presenters.
All right.
Thank you.
Sounds good. All right, Yano. So I'll take the next few slides, and then I will send it back to you to talk about the remote sensors. Let me move on here. All right. Thank you, everyone, for the questions. So we have one more poll question here. Does your post-remediation care plan consider multiple lines of evidence? Or is it simply a visual observation, yes, no, sort of a line of evidence? I'm going to go into why we had to use multiple lines of evidence. So here we've got our upland areas, pavement cover, visual inspection. Are there significant cracks that have opened to a width that exposes soil beneath, et cetera? Those are the things that we look for. We can confirm visually that the cap is intact and still protective. Same with the stone armored shoreline. We can do visual inspections to make sure that none of the stones have shifted or come out of place and none of the underlying sediment has been exposed. No degradation either. We can also equally evaluate the sheet pile bulkheads. We can't see them entirely, but we can observe them from a dive. Moving on. Underwater, to evaluate the cap, however, we can't see everything. It would be expensive and it would be challenging from a safety perspective to send divers in routinely to visually inspect the cap. But we also need to be able to evaluate the stone armor shoreline and the bulkheads. These monitoring systems need to be protective of human health and the environment, as well as protective of the people doing the inspections. And we need to ensure that the inspection is thorough enough to evaluate the cap integrity. We need to have a flexible design for differential settlement. So you can see here we've got between 70 to 80 feet in any given place of soft compressible Hudson River sediments with varying levels of debris near the surface. We've also got some pretty heavy armor on top of the cap as the upper layer. We observed 1 foot of primary settlement, as Janos talked about, during construction. So we knew it happened right when we installed the material. We did also anticipate 4 and additional 3 inches of secondary settlement and potential creep as this is happening. So it looks like everybody's looking at multiple lines of evidence in their post-remediation care plans, and that's a good thing, especially when you have something that you can't see. So here, right. So again, you know, due to limited access and safety concerns, we needed to use multiple lines of evidence in our protectiveness evaluation. So we ended up using bathymetry and remote sensing. Both paired together provides a effective evaluation of the integrity of that cap. One alone would not suffice. This allows us to monitor the varying degrees of settlement as well as the cap stability and integrity. The monitoring is done on an annual basis at a minimum, with an additional provision for monitoring events following major storm events. So with that, we're going to move over into the remote sensing, and I'll kick it to Janos again. Janos, you out there?
Gene, did you unmute me?
Yes, we can.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks, Michael. So like Michael said, we have to monitor the sediment cap in perpetuity. And as you see, there's constraints underneath the building. And we were required to do a minimum per EPA and NYSDEC, 1 monitoring event per year, and then another event in the event there was a named storm. So if a Superstorm Sandy or Hurricane Irene came, or a named nor'easter event that brought a large tidal surge, we would have to do a second monitoring event that calendar year. So we wanted a reliable, redundant data set to supplement the bathymetric measurements, which we could collect from the interior of the building. We cored 6-inch diameter holes through the floor slab, and we were using weighted rods to correctly gauge the sediment cap to the top of the EPRI building floor to do your bathymetric survey measurements. But with the settlement, with the secondary creep, we were concerned about false positives that the cap was moving away from us. It was settling. So we came up with a remote sensing system of fiber optic cables. So fiber optic cables have familiar traits that allow for localized event monitoring to evaluate for damage. The fiber optic cables include sensors that allow you to measure its location, its traits in space. Along that fiber optic cable, you can measure temperature and strain. So that's what was selected as our redundant sediment cap monitoring approach. Okay? The sediment cap monitoring, the remote sensors provide an economical purchase as well as an installation and monitoring cost. It provides a continuous linear sensor that tells us the location, where you are, the average strain and temperature properties, the magnitude, how much strain, and this is real-time measurements if you wanted it to be. Remote sensors, fiber optic cables are used a lot in the large water and gas transmission line. industry, and we deployed it here, not real-time monitoring, just on the annual event. And the tables are designed for a minimum 30-year design life, so they have long-term stability. And you could read these cables up to 40 miles, thankfully, and you'll see a little later on, our design is up to 100 meters long. The remote sensors, the fiber optic cables, work on the time of flight principle, where there's 4-millimeter strain sensors and 2-millimeter temperature sensors. The strain range is -1.5% for compression to a +1.5% for elongation. And then the temperature range is -20°C to 70°C. And they basically use the Brillouin scattering effect, which allows for the reproducible response. And what we do is we monitor these cables every year, and we compare those measurements to the previous year to detect any movement. So what we do is we arrive on site with a dye test reading unit. We apply a signal through those sensors, and we're measuring that frequency shift on the scattered light to detect any movements. And since we know the cable length from the previous year and from the previous measurements, we could perform repeatable measurements and compare it to see if there has been any strain, any movement on the wire. And if there is, then we would know where it happened on a sediment cap, and then we could deploy a diver to inspect that area of the sediment cap. So this is a typical readout. That's the dye test unit. This is the dye test unit here. That's the readout. It's giving you your strain monitoring, your temperature monitoring. This is a cross-section of the cable that was installed. We installed the temperature as well as the strain cables. You could install other cables for other monitoring efforts, but for our sediment cap, it wasn't necessary. We were specifically concerned with strain and temperature. So what happens is, this table represents the multiple readout units. This was a worst case. This is a dam failure project showing what happened. But you're creating location maps and color coding per event, and then you're comparing it to the previous event to see if you had a creep, you had strain. So it's a clean, visible representation for the regulators. So what we did is, the original approach was we were going to wire it into the reactive core mat, but the concern was deploying the fiber optic cable. So we worked with the contractor as well as the fiber optic cable manufacturer. We came in with these 4-foot by 4-foot concrete blocks. We basically put electrical conduit in that concrete block, and then we deployed the concrete block, and then we came in later and strung the fiber optic cable from the concrete block up the H-pile to a main batten board inside the building, which I'll show you a picture of later on. So these load cells were installed. We installed 10 of them throughout the entire building, to get a good representation of the sediment cap and if it's moving. So the sediment cap, we put sensors, 4 of them were along that zone 1, so we really were focused on zone 1, the wave affected zone, and then the other 5 sensors were along the perimeter as well as the western or outer edge of the sediment cap. And they were installed first as individual loops, and then the whole wire fiber optic network was then fused together to create one continuous single scan loop. Okay? So what happens is we then installed it. We installed it in the summer of 2016, and to date we've had four monitoring events to evaluate the effectiveness of the CAT. So you could see this picture on the right is the first three events, 16, 17, and 2018, where we monitored the frequency of the light transmitting through the 700-meter-long cable, okay? We did not see any variances. We did not see any significant strain or any temperatures. So we saw and we concluded after each event that there's no significant change from the previous event and that the sediment cap is stable and it remains integral and continues to operate as designed. So we have four events underneath our belt to date. We have our fifth event, the 2020 event, scheduled for this August. And what we do is we do the bathymetry, and the same day we rent the dye test unit, and we apply the signal through the fiber optic cables at the surface inside the EPRI building. Okay, just a little side note, sediment cap integrity as well as the contingency plans. In March of 2018, there was a large nor'easter with a backwater effect and tidal flooding that hit the Westchester County area. I showed you a picture earlier of this barge floating in the Hudson River. Well, that night, the barge struck ground at our site immediately north of the EPRI building and the sediment cap. It thankfully only damaged the timber walkway for the steel bulkhead. It did not affect the steel bulkhead or the bulkhead whalers. And it got hung up on some dolphins as well as this bulkhead before it hit the sediment cap. But in 2018, we did have to do two monitoring events. One, the first event was after this storm event, this nor'easter, where we had the tidal surge. And then the typical August event where we do our annual monitoring. So, like Michael said before, you have to build in that contingency. And thankfully, we over-designed this project, and we were able to, unfortunately, receive this runaway barge and our sediment cap as well as our engineering controls. The shoreline bulkhead was saved. As a quick note, this Blue Q building, in addition to its fame in the movies, it caught this barge in the winter. It was New Year's Eve of 2013. A small passenger plane flew out of New Jersey and was flying to Connecticut. It lost function. It was trying to land at a park right along the shoreline right above this site. It's called the JFK Memorial Park. While it couldn't make the park, it landed in the Hudson River. It floated down. It was caught by the EPRI building, and the Yonkers Fire Department was able to come to our site, cut our locks off, meander through the remediation area, and rescue the husband and wife that were floating in their plane. So this building has also caught numerous boats that have drifted, and the Hudson River pilots familiar with this area. So that's a quick side note on the building. With that, I open it up again to SMP questions, please, Jean.
Okay, so I don't see any specific questions on the SMP, but we have had questions that came in earlier regarding monitoring. So there were a number of questions asking exactly what type of monitoring has been required with your cap integrity, and they were just wondering what kind of testing have you been doing to confirm the cap effectiveness.
So what the last couple of slides were, we're doing bathymetric survey measurements, and then we're doing this remote sensing, the fiber optic cable measurements. Because we can't see the sediment cap, it's below the water, we're relying on bathymetry, comparing that to the previous year measurements, and then we're also using the remote sensing, the fiber optic cables, to detect strain and temperature variances to see if the cap has moved. In the first 4 years, we have not seen cap movement, and we have not required a diver inspection. In the event, say, we see significant strain in load cell number 5, we would then deploy a dive team to go and inspect that load cell, inspect the sediment cap in and around that load cell to see if they see evidence of movement, of scour, of a tree came down the river below the water surface and dislodged some of that stone or whatever happened.
Okay. I think you got it, but if I see a clarifying question, I'll let you know. There was also a question about a debris survey, so I'm scrolling back here to some earlier questions. Did you conduct a debris survey before you attempted dredging?
Yes. Multiple debris surveys were performed. The initial one was during the sediment sampling. It was done by a combination of Ponar dredge, small bucket dredges, as well as vibrocores, where we saw in the Ponar dredges some of the cables, and we saw the stone in the vibrocores. So we knew that there was some debris concerns. And then the first dive attempt underneath the building was diver-assisted dredging, and they reported a lot of heavy cables and debris, and we did a robust dive survey as part of the initial 6 dredge attempts. When we did the open water work, we saw the cables, but that was done with a large barge-mounted excavator so we could pick it up. Then when we did the final 6 dredge attempts, before we would turn on the suction dredge on the robotic excavator, he would scrape the bottom of the floor to see if he hit rebar or H-piles or timbers. Unfortunately, that wasn't very effective, and we learned it the hard way. That's how we got the machine stuck twice, once with the rocks and once with just fluffing the sediment on top of them. And then finally, when we did the sediment cap, we did a detailed debris survey to find any mounds. If we did find mounds, we had a raking system where we had a small tender push boat pulling a rake to flatten out that before we placed the cushion sand. And then once the cushion sand was placed and before we placed the reactive core mat, we did another raking survey to make sure that the cushion sand was level and there were no protrusions coming up through the cushion sand that could potentially rip or damage the reactive core mat.
Okay. I think we'll just take one last question, and then we do have a few final items that we'll need to go through. So I know we're coming right up at that scheduled end time, but we may go a minute or two over. So I apologize to the audience. But this last question, can you give a rough rule of thumb for the cost for that scan crawler?
That scan crawler, just the scan crawler itself, mobilizing and the operations was a multi-million-dollar effort. And then it was another multi-million-dollar effort to deploy the dredge management area, the wastewater treatment plan. So we were using about $350 a cubic yard. That was the cost all in for the scan crawler, the support crew on topside inside the EPRI building to operate that scan crawler. And then with all the dredge management area and the water treatment plant and that necessary labor force to support that effort, you're looking about $350 a cubic yard for dredging.
Okay. Why don't we carry on and close out the presentation, and then I'll walk through a few final reminders. So I'll turn it back to you.
Sorry, thank you. So the lessons learned here were effective program management to stay in front of the regulators and make sure you earn their credibility and trust. And once you have positive momentum, once we obtain that initial approval of the sediment cap, just maintain that momentum throughout the regulatory process. Just keep the pressure on them, keep the gas pedal down on the floor and pushing the design process through the regulators. And then communication, since NYSDEC was the lead agency, just assisting them with coordinating with the EPA, with the Army Corps, with the National Marine Fisheries Services to make sure everything is communicating, effectively communicating in a timely manner to keep the project rolling. As Michael said before, the constructability review was very important, working with the contractors to value engineer the project. As Michael said before, we had two design concepts, the Ajax and then the stone riprap. The material costs were pretty much the same for Ajax versus the stone riprap. However, the construction cost for the Ajax was astronomically more. So that's why we went with the stone riprap. And then the peer reviews, we welcomed them. We had several peer reviews from third-party folks to make sure that our design was permittable and constructible. So we valued that and we appreciated that. Thank you. And as Michael said at the start, thank you, EPA, for giving us the opportunity to share this project and to share our triumphs and tribulations. Thank you again, EPA, Catherine, and Jean, for your guidance and support.
Excellent. Thank you so very much, Janos. So I think I'm going to walk through just a few final reminders before we close things out today. I know we are just past that scheduled end time, so I wanted to thank the over 150 people who joined us for today's live broadcast. Now, I'll just remind everyone that this is part of an ongoing series, so the previous sessions that have been hosted by SAMI are already posted on the CLUIN archive page, so you can visit us there and browse through and take a look at the previous sessions in this series. But this one was also archived and will be posted on that site as well. You'll automatically get an email as soon as the archive is available for on-demand playback. I also encourage you to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month, where we typically highlight free webinars like today's session. Now, the other reminder, we have copies of the presentation materials already posted on the seminar homepage, so you would have visited that page when you were checking in today. It's also available on the middle right under related URLs. For those of you who are recording or playing back the recorded version, those links will still work. So if for some reason you are unable to click the link to the seminar resources and press browse to, I've also included the URLs right in the Q&A window. You can click from there or just copy and type that URL in to access the slides. As noted, there's contact information for our presenters on the homepage and as part of their presentation materials. And I'll ask each of you to fill out the brief online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. One of the most common requests I get is if we offer CEUs or PDHs, and while we don't offer those credit hours, many participants are able to document their attendance and get credit for participating in these sessions. If you fill out that feedback form and make sure that you check the box at the bottom of the form that certifies you were here for the whole thing or replayed the whole thing, as soon as you submit the feedback form, you'll then have immediate access to either download or print out a participation certificate. Oftentimes, people can take that along with a copy of the slides and the information from the homepage to document their participation and get credit with their own institution. So again, if you watch the recorded version, you can still click the link over to the feedback form. You'll see it on the right side of your screen and fill out that feedback form based off of your replay of the archive. So with that, I want to thank all of our organizers and presenters who took time to help put today's session together as well as share their expertise and answer your questions. I want to thank our audience for being engaged and asking a lot of really great questions about today's topic. And with that, we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live